Welcome to Berlin Inside Out, the podcast that takes an expert look at how Germany sees the world and the world sees Germany, with me, Benjamin Tallis.
And me, Aaron Gash Burnett.
Welcome back to Berlin Inside Out, the podcast that takes an expert look at international politics from Berlin in association with the German Council on Foreign Relations. I'm Benjamin Tallis, Senior Research Fellow here at the Council, and I'm here with my friend and co-host Aaron Gash Burnett, a journalist specializing in German politics. Now, Aaron, we have a very special guest today.
We do indeed. Our very sharp friend Oliver Moody is here with us today for this special bonus episode marking the halfway point of our season. Oliver is the Berlin correspondent for the Times of London, where he covers Germany, but also, we should point out, the entire Central and East European region, as well as the Nordics. In addition to Germany, he's recently covered the Polish election, crime in Sweden, innovation in Finland, while also partaking in a sauna or two, and many other topics. Hello, Oliver. Welcome to the show.
Hello. You've been reading me more assiduously than my own editors have. And thank you very much for the invitation. I have been religiously listening to the podcast, and frankly, I've been disgusted by how much of it I've agreed with so far. And I'd like to know when you're going to get a proper guest on, like Richard David Precht or Ulrike Gero.
Yeah, you might be waiting till season 39 for them to appear, I think. But yes, that is shocking to hear, given how you and I usually talk, Ollie. So we'll see what we can do today to bring some spice back into the Baltic sorbet that we're providing.
A spicy sorbet, we hope it is. From here on in, listeners, our first season is pivoting a bit to focus on specific relationships. That's part of why we have Oliver here today, that Germany has with other countries, specifically key allies and partners, starting off with Central and Eastern Europe, the Baltics, the Nordics over the next few episodes. In addition to his day job, Oliver is currently writing a book about the Baltic as a region, where he visits a key place in the 9 countries on the Baltic Sea, one of which is in Germany itself, of course. So Oliver, tell us about why you wanted to write this book and why you structured it in the way that you have.
Well, really, the book came out of one of the worst holidays I've ever been on. Which began on February the 25th, 2022, when I was boarding a plane for Portugal with my wife and our 2 young children. The phone rang and the editor said, "Very sorry, can you come back, please?" But it was too late, so I ended up sitting there in this freezing house in the Algarve, trying to tie together all of the coverage of the secondary effects of Russia's reinvasion of Ukraine, and seeing how Germany responded with Scholz's famous Zeitenwende speech 2 days after that. But above all, seeing the astonishing shift in Central and Eastern Europe, and in particular, the way that Poland was suddenly absorbing all of those Ukrainian war refugees. And it really consolidated a realization that had been dawning for a while, that the action, the center of geopolitical gravity in Europe, has been moving eastwards for some time. And yet there is very little decent popular coverage that ties these various strands together for an audience. So I thought it was about time somebody wrote a book like that.
The tough life of a journalist suffering in a house down on the Algarve, coming up with ideas about how to change the way we understand Europe. Oliver, something that really intrigued me when reading the summary of the book, the proposal that you made, is from that moment that you took there, that you describe, which I think all of us remember extremely well, how we were thinking and trying to make sense of an evolving situation at that time. You write that now we're in a moment of tremendous uncertainty and anxiety still, but also a moment of hope and possibility, a chance to create something better than we had before. And in that, you see the Baltic as key, not just as a frontier region when it comes to security, but also a frontier region of our future.
This is going to be one of the absolutely central contentions of the book, that while we in Western Europe or North America have got very used to thinking about the Baltic as a region of strategic vulnerability, because of the precarious geographic and historical positions of a lot of these countries, in many ways, they have over the centuries evolved to become in a better place to cope with the realities that we're now having to come to terms with across the West by virtue of their own experiences. And in many ways, I think that they're more across these problems than we are. And that applies not just to security in a military sense, but to things like grand strategy to energy security to political resilience to how you might want to try and inoculate a society against disinformation to the ability to reform the military and above all to being able to mobilize a civilian population towards what you feel to be either in accord with your national interests or values.
That sounds a lot like another theme that we've had on this show, which is seeing a vulnerability as opportunity. What sort of opportunities actually exist in that region and do they present Europe with?
Well, the opportunities are really across just about every conceivable area of public policy. If you're now thinking of public policy in a joined-up sense, where pretty much everything that a government does has the potential to contribute to or detract from a country's or a region's security. And so you can think about it as an opportunity in terms of the way that some of these countries have been driving foreign policy innovation across the wider West, or certainly in a European context. You could think about it in terms of how we manage the climate transition, where really the Nordic countries bordering on the Baltic Sea have done some tremendously interesting and forward-thinking things that we can learn from. You can also think about opportunity in terms of how we deal with the radical right, which has had at least a taste of power in 8 of the 9 countries bordering on the Baltic Sea. And there are some very interesting experiences there in how you can sort of learn to respond to this instability in the political system.
This is so interesting also because it's something of a role reversal, at least in the common Western imagination. As you say, we in Western Europe and North America had perhaps become complacent, and that's why we were shocked when what happened in February last year happened. But not only were the Baltic states, for example, more right about Russia, very clearly so, and have been more prepared for this for a long time. As you say, they've taken that and seized it, run with it, to come up with a more compelling vision for the future that goes across different policy areas. And this questions a lot of the old stereotypes about Central and Eastern Europe in particular. You mentioned at some point that this is a region that has been overlooked, patronized, and so on, but that's far more true for some parts of the region than others, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you could definitely make a case that, well, Germany, for example, which is a Baltic state, however much it may act in a manner that suggests it isn't, and certainly some of the Nordic countries have had their fair share of attention. Although even then, I would argue that security thinking in countries like Finland and Sweden has been grossly neglected from the outside. And we have actually got a lot to learn from Finland's traditions of really broad spectrum security thinking, but also from how Sweden organized its society during the Cold War and the lessons that it unlearned after 1990. But yes, exactly as you say, there are the three Baltic states, which are now really coming into focus and becoming an object of envy for a lot of Western European capitals, where really that long period of neglect is being made up for. And then Poland is a fascinating case in itself. And I think it's going to be absolutely crucial to determining the future of Europe, not just in a security sense, but in a political sense too.
Right. And it's with wrestling with some of the contradictions that exist in Poland very clearly, contradictions between approach to security on an international level and approach to liberal governance at home, that I think, you know, you highlight very well how this region can be a microcosm or seen as a microcosm of some of the wider tests that we are failing to meet elsewhere. And so this notion from the past, from Larry Wolf, that there's a Europe that knows and a Europe that waits to be known, and that Europe that waits to be known is always Eastern Europe, is really overturned by this new thinking.
That's correct. And also, I think it's very salutary to turn that lens around and sit there from the perspective of Riga or Tallinn or Warsaw and look at France and Germany through their eyes and realize, you know, how little we understand about our own vulnerabilities and blind spots and internal contradictions and how much we might be able to understand better from their perspective.
Right, exactly. And that's something that historians of Central Eastern Europe in particular have been very keen to emphasize for a long time now, that if, for example, you write the history of the 20th century from Prague, it looks very different than if you write it from Paris or New York. And so understanding those multiple perspectives can help us actually get a better idea of our collective strengths, our collective opportunities, but also how we can face down the challenges and what our vulnerabilities actually are. And one relationship that's going to be key to doing that is the German-Polish relationship, isn't it, Aaron?
Absolutely. And with this particular, with the last election, of course, which you were very active in covering for the Times, we now have a new constellation of power in Poland at the moment, and headed by someone who used to be a president of the European Council. Do you think a Poland under Donald Tusk is going to be able to assert a bigger EU role vis-a-vis France in Germany?
Well, I think it's important to put this answer in a little bit of context, in that Poland is currently embarking on an absolutely staggering program of military expansion. The plan is, at least on paper, to have more tanks than France, Germany and Britain combined, to more than double the size of the armed forces, to more than 250,000 soldiers. They are buying jets and artillery in incredible quantity. At the same time, the economy is growing so rapidly that there are projections suggesting Poland could become a net contributor to the European Union's budget by the early 2030s, particularly if Ukraine joins the Union. And most interestingly, a very strong Polish foreign policy tradition that some historians have described as messianic. This idea that there is a transcendental, almost mystical purpose to Poland's historic suffering and has been ever since partitions. And that Poland has a mission to be the kind of guardian of liberty within its neighbourhood, but also as a kind of beacon to the wider world. And so the really central question in Poland has been, before this election and increasingly afterwards, to what extent Poland is going to fulfil that potential. And the answer has up to now been a very complicated one. In some ways, Poland has tried to use its regional multilateral formats, things like the Three Seas Initiative or the Lublin Triangle or the Riga Four with the Baltic states, to assert a regional leadership role. But if you talk to anyone involved in foreign policy in Poland for more than 30 seconds, they'll bring up Germany. And so that really means that the central question now is how Donald Tusk is going to try and normalize this relationship with Berlin.
Messianic vision for foreign policy and Poland as guardian of liberty, that's going to raise some eyebrows in Berlin, isn't it?
Absolutely. It would. I mean, there is this notion that you often come up against talking to Polish officials and politicians and analysts, that Germany has aspirations to play a leadership role in Central and Eastern Europe. Poland also has the aspirations to play a similar role, and that those two aspirations are inevitably going to run into conflict with each other. And so the question, I think, from Berlin's perspective and from the perspective of the next Polish government, which, as Aaron, you said, will probably be led by Donald Tusk at the head of a very complicated coalition of three alliances with something like 8 or 9 parties within it. And their grand challenge is how to make that relationship work in a constructive way that ensures that those two leadership roles could potentially be in a synergy. At this moment, by the way, when we are talking about reshaping the institutional DNA of the European Union to make it fit for enlargement, and how they can somehow together corral and represent and balance the differences of opinion, not just in Central and Eastern Europe, but also if you look towards France, in a way that actually leads to some kind of grand bargain that leaves the eastern half of Europe feeling represented.
You've spoken, Oliver, about this change that Poland's going through, the massive rearmament program and so on. Has Germany even realized that's happening? Has it reacted to that or adjusted to it? And what do you think about the likely change in government in Poland? Does that make it easier or harder for Berlin? Because now they won't be able to simply dismiss Warsaw as a bunch of right-wing lunatics.
Which they've often done in the past, right? It's been...
That's right, ignoring the substance of Warsaw's critique quite often.
To answer your first question, I mean, of course it hasn't escaped the German government's notice that Poland is going through this gigantic transformation, not least because it's of enormous economic benefit to Germany. And this is an aspect of the otherwise very dysfunctional political relationship that Berlin has been very keen to keep advancing. And the Poles have also been quite happy with that, by the way. But recognizing Poland's potential is not the same as taking it seriously in strategic and policy terms. And what I think there has been a failure to do so far is to recognize that this status is the militarily primary front state that West Germany once occupied during the Cold War is now shifting to Poland, and to plan your own security and foreign policy accordingly. To answer your second question, which I think is a very insightful one about whether things might actually be harder under a Tusk government, I think that is justified up to the point where it has been very easy for Berlin up to now to argue that Poland's complaints were purely the product of inward-looking right-wing populism. That is much harder now. At the same time, however, the central obstacle to a functioning German-Polish relationship is Poland's demand for 1.3 trillion in war reparations. And behind that is all kinds of unresolved tension over whether Germany has really come to terms with what Nazi Germany did in Poland during the Second World War. And there I actually see auguries of a compromise deal that is there to be had. The really big question there is whether the Law and Justice Party has managed to change the political dynamics in Poland so much that Tusk is constrained by his own coalition and by peace in opposition not to be able to make the compromises with the Germans that he needs to make in order for Berlin to be able to come forward and do its half of the deal.
Yes, absolutely. And that's one of the points about the substance largely remaining the same, either through political constraint or through the fact it's a shared position on many issues. And I guess for me, the big question comes to see whether indeed the change in tone is enough to allow Berlin to really recognize that substance that is there, first of all, but secondly, to actually wake up to the fact that Poland is now in this frontline position, as you mentioned, and is ready to become a strategic leader in its own right. Can Germany actually act in a following role, or can it cope with this model of diffused leadership around Europe? Which also rather begs the question, is Germany more widely or more generally able to learn from the Baltics, as well as willing to learn from the Baltic countries, broadly put, the Baltic states, Poland and the North?
To be perfectly honest, I've seen very little sign that German foreign policy makers have the amount of spare bandwidth or self-reflection at this point to learn from anyone about how to start thinking in a strategic way.
There was me thinking you were going to be all diplomatic about that.
that sounds harsh, but if you consider the situation from the German government's perspective, everything's on fire right now. And in the polls, foreign and security policy issues are coming up as the fifth or sixth highest priority at best.
That's the opinion polls, not the Baltic polls.
There you go. And what the voters really care about right now is immigration. It's the future of industry. It is the welfare state. It is the cost of living. It's energy and climate as well. They've got the AfD breathing down their necks on all of these issues. And so I just think the whole concept of trying to reconstruct German foreign policy from the bottom up has really lost its momentum. And that if there was a window of opportunity for the Titan vendor in that sense, it's slammed shut.
Which is something that the Baltic states, for example, got right. They seized the moment. Lithuania introducing its Indo-Pacific strategy, actually taking that chance to build from the bottom up, going from a principal position of already heightened readiness to saying, actually, there's a moment here to use that to go across policy fields and really think big. But that's not been the case here.
We recently had our guest Jan Eichhorn on, who did tell us that the German public does, in fact, at a bottom-up level, care about some of these questions, even if they don't necessarily occupy the very high level in terms of priority, and that immigration might, or that the future of industry or everything else might. So I might push back and say that the opportunity does certainly exist, and the public would support it if we were to see that kind of leadership.
Aaron, I know this is a point that you have underlined time and again throughout this podcast series, and it's correct. Of course, it's correct. What we saw after February the 24th last year in German public opinion was a remarkable transformation and a real sign of hope to me that with the right political leadership and under the right conditions, this is a country where people are willing to make sacrifices and to mobilize themselves and to see change happen. They want to feel that that change is justified and there's a point to it, and that it's fair. What I would challenge, though, is whether these issues now occupy anything like the same level of kind of urgent priority that they would have had even 6 or 9 or 12 months ago, let alone in the immediate aftermath of the second invasion of Ukraine.
Yeah, and it's interesting, your chapter in the book on Germany centers on the north, on Mecklenburg-Gazprommen territory. Lubmin and Greifswald.
Oliver, you and I have actually talked about this before. Germany has often seen relationships with countries in the Baltic, particularly the Baltic states, but also others, mostly as ways to manage the overall larger relationship with Russia. So having a diplomatic relationship with Latvia or Estonia or Lithuania in the past in German foreign policy has been a lot about using these countries as bridges to manage the overall relationship with Russia.
As Jan Masaryk, a famous statesman from Central Eastern Europe, put it, a bridge is what gets walked over.
Precisely. So we can certainly discuss and debate how successful that particular approach was. What challenge does Germany have in terms of actually having a strategy in relating to these countries in their own right, as opposed to that approach of yesterday?
I could reply to that question with a bunch of banalities and platitudes.
Oh, please do.
About listening.
Please don't.
And compromise and dealing with them respectfully and actually taking seriously what they have to say. And those are things that have to be done, platitudinous as they sound. In some cases, particularly with Poland, there are a whole bunch of very specific policy things that Germany could do if it really wanted to repair the relationship. But the single biggest thing that we learn, I think, from looking at Germany through the eyes of somewhere like the Baltic States or Finland or Poland is what they're interested in is, what do you want? What fundamentally are you coming out to try and get? What do you want to do with Europe? How do you want to work with us? How are you defining your interests here? And in a Baltic context, a good example of that is the latest meeting of the Council of the Baltic Sea States, which Germany was chairing this year. And in June, they met in Wismar on the Baltic coast in Mecklenburg-Vorpommern. Ben?
Thanks, Oliver. The pronunciation's not my thing.
And Annalena Baerbock, the German foreign minister, addressed this summit. And the priority that she pulled out of the bag was clearing the Second World War era chemical munitions that had been dumped in the Baltic Sea in 1945. Now, there are about 40,000 tons of these mustard gas shells and so on rotting away in two locations at a depth of about 70 meters below the surface, east of Bornholm and about halfway between the Swedish island of Gotland and Latvia. And researchers actually argue the toss about whether it even makes sense to go to the enormous expense of trying to clear them or not. This is your priority. You are, you know, the framework nation for the Baltic in a time of drastic upheaval where countries are looking to you for leadership. They're looking to you for a plan.
At a time when the Baltic has become Lake NATO.
And we're talking about dredging for mustard gas shells from 1945.
Yeah, I mean, again, Germany retreating into the comfort of dealing with its own past sins rather than facing the future. I mean, that might seem an odd thing to say, but it seems as though that's where Germany finds itself stuck. And the future direction part of what you were asking before is far, far, far less clear. And this is something that we've emphasized time and again here at DGAP, is that Germany needs to make itself knowable to its partners as well as making itself known. So again, this thing about which Europe waits to be known, at the moment, it's very much Germany that waits to be known. Because it's masking its interests, it's masking its clear direction. Its national security strategy was not a strategy. There is no clear foreign policy identity. And this, at least if there were, however disagreeable it may be, there would be something that allies could relate to.
I mean, does Germany know what it wants? I mean, you posed this question earlier, that this is something that Germany's partners in the region are wanting to know. Oh, you know, what do you want? But does it actually know what it wants?
Well, I mean, at the risk of going down this kind of cursed hell path of sub-Aeschylean woo, it is about knowing yourself here, right?
Can you just explain to our listeners and me what on earth that meant?
Know thyself.
Aeschylus being the Greek tragedian who famously had gnothis auton, know yourself, and that was written on the theatre at Delphi, I believe.
Our very own oracle there, Oliver Moody. Thank you very much indeed.
Anyway, the point is, I think at the root of so many of these policy dilemmas that Germany is facing, and by no means just in the foreign and security policy domain, is a really central question of identity. What kind of country is Germany? Is it comfortable with the social changes that it's going through? Where does it think it's going? And that in turn is a question of political leadership. It really requires someone to come forward and say, this is why I think all of the sacrifices that are going to be required of us have a purpose, they have a point, and why I think you should come and make them with me. And this is how things are going to improve. And this is the place Germany is going to take.
Sounding dangerously like a neo-idealist there, Oliver.
Perish the thought.
However, Oliver, I will say, bringing up the whole point of neo-idealists.
See what we did there?
I know from talking to you, this is also a reason why you chose to write this book, so you're not going to get away from this question that easily. We have seen a lot of neo-idealists come from the Baltic region. Ben, you and I have spoken about this on a previous episode of the podcast, episode 4, listeners, just in case, about Sanna Marin or Kaya Kallas or, you know...
Gabrielis Landsbergis.
Exactly. Why is it countries in this region that seem to be churning out the most neo-idealists? These are people that also seem to be generating the most ambitious in relating to the world's authoritarians. We look, for example, at Lithuania's strategy, Indo-Pacific strategy, or strategy in managing China, all of those kinds of things. You know, is this a reason why you were attracted to the region?
It is the underlying sense of flux and possibility and comfort with instability, a sense that it's okay and that we can make something of this, that I think is really kind of sadly lacking in Western Europe, where this discourse does feel very tired and caught in a time loop and quite hopeless sometimes. Why have so many neo-idealist leaders come out of the region? Might speculate that it's got something to do with small states that give you a certain sense of agility and a lack of kind of pre-existing elaborate diplomatic and business ties that make it harder to make those kind of decisions. There's also something to do with the fact that the Baltic states only regained their independence just over 3 decades ago. So the political compass is very much up for grabs, but also, as exactly as you say, the experience of fighting for their autonomy is well within living memory, and in fact within the careers of some of the politicians.
Why freedom matters.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, the Baltic, come for the flux and possibility, stay for the vision of the future, as our new regional tourist board slogan.
The herring's very good as well.
There you go, something for everyone. I think you're right to talk about it being related to small states, smaller states. But smaller states would, in this case, include Poland and would include others as well, who are non-traditional great powers in international relations, as it's often known. But crucially, what unites them is the understanding that international order keeps them safe, and a democratic and liberal international order keeps them safe. So relating what you said to that agility, flexibility, possibility that comes from smallness, so too does vulnerability. And understanding how to marry the two in a way that requires your friends and neighbours. Now, that hasn't traditionally been a strength of Germany's, as it still sees itself largely as a great power in a strange way, but nonetheless sees itself as a great power. Would it help if Germany started to see the world a bit more like a smaller state?
I don't know to what extent that's a realistic thing to ask of Germany. I think sometimes about that famous quote from Peter Strzok when he was defense minister back in 2005, justifying Germany's involvement in the Afghan war to the public. And he said, well, you know, our safety is being defended there on the Hindu Kush. And this idea that your security could be affected by something that is not an immediate territorial threat is something that's pretty hard to convey to a country that's got used to 30 years of being surrounded by friends and allies. And so much as I would like German public discourse to be more like it is in Estonia or Finland, for example, I just am not sure that that is possible.
Yeah, I mean, the question of relative size comes into play, of course, because Germany, while it is big in many ways, world's fourth largest economy, it's not without its power, even if its military is underfunded, as we've discussed widely. But compared to some of the other powers now at work and on the planet, it is smaller. And so understanding that relative smallness might come to be something that would do Germany the power of good. Relative humility as part of a team, playing together with those others, learning from the Baltic states in some of the ways that your book describes, understanding what it could productively take from them, letting them set the pace where necessary. That would be something that would move Germany towards being something more of a team player, a team power perhaps, while being potentially still first among equals.
Let's put it another way. Germany often credits its huge success and stability with the fact that it is actually a part of a big team, and that team is the European Union, for example. It often sees itself, you know, whether implicitly or explicitly, as having the right to lead that team all the time. But why is it so hard for German policymakers sometimes to necessarily think of themselves as being on a team when so much of its success is derived from being a part of one? Plenty of German political elites will tell you that. They'll have no issue telling you that. You know, we're convinced Europeans and we're on this team.
I actually think that Germany's political leaders are very comfortable, if not too comfortable, with the idea of Germany being team captain, and would view that as being not only Germany's natural role, but a role that it has exercised with great aplomb and success for the past 30 years, if not longer.
Now, that view might not be shared across the Baltic. Is that right? Fair thing to say, Oliver?
That there might be the odd capital here and there that would
slightly
beg to differ.
Dissenting voices.
It's conceivable. Yeah.
Are a few of those capitals a short train ride away?
But this suggests to me that what we really need to do is think more precisely about what we're really talking about when we talk about a team and how those parts play together and what the captain is supposed to be doing in terms of leadership. I'm not really convinced that we have that basic level of understanding about how these different parts fit together yet to fit Germany into it.
I would very much agree with that. And that's something I think that a lot of dedicated foreign policy thinking is going into at the moment. And we need much more of it. We need to work out from each of those capitals how they would see themselves as fitting into that and what roles there are on the team, which roles they're comfortable with playing, how those might change over time or might be flexible or whether they're fixed. And that's, I think, something that smaller states tend to object to, is those kind of fixity of roles that, say, being characterized, put in a small box. But that's something that's very much up for grabs. Something else that comes into question, I thought, when thinking about your book, is the concept of what makes a region. Is it really a region, though? And what makes up a region? And what made you think of this as a region?
It's regional quality is a paradox in that, on one level, it is, in the view of a lot of political scientists who study regionality, the single most densely networked region on the planet in economic and in multilateral terms. And I would argue that it is also the most successful example of stitching back together the two halves of Europe that were once separated by the Iron Curtain. In strategic terms, for NATO's defense planning, it is indubitably and categorically a region. And yet, at the same time, when I tell people about the book, you would be astonished how often people go, oh, yeah, the Baltic states. And sometimes they even know the names of the Baltic states. And it just doesn't occur to them that this would be a region that would also encompass somewhere like Germany or Denmark or Sweden.
Which is remarkable, considering, for example, the UK's ties to the Baltic. I remember my childhood spent partly in Liverpool. I've recovered mainly, I think, since then. But there was even a pub called the Baltic Fleet. And this is a place where we had connections to. We had big connections to the Baltic, more widely put. Where did those go?
Yeah, I've had some very embarrassing experiences going around the west coast of Finland. It's remarkable how many cities we were able to bombard over the centuries. I mean, it's not just Britain, it's the Netherlands, it's Germany that have played absolutely decisive roles in shaping the history of the Baltic and then just promptly forgotten about them.
Yeah, I mean, the Hansa, of course, massive in the Baltic. Unifying force, and exactly one of those who introduced many of the things you discuss about in your book, the spread of German-speaking peoples, the spread of particular trade conventions, habits, customs, currencies, etc., that help knit things together, and then seemingly still, you rightly write, overlooked and patronized.
Yeah, the other thing to mention in this context is that there isn't really a sense of Baltic identity, to the point where I would go so far as to venture that most people who live around the Baltic are pretty ignorant of the parts of the Baltic that are outside their immediate micro-region. So when I've been traveling around Scandinavia, for example, they are very economically interlinked with the Baltic states, but they know almost nothing about them. And I guess a lot of people in the Baltic states will probably be a lot more conscious of those ties in reverse, given, you know, how the kind of kit that seeded the nuclei of the Baltic armed forces after 1991 was largely kind of Swedish army surplus stuff that they were shedding as, you know, they relaxed into the end of history.
A fair amount came from former East German suppliers as well that had to be approved for sending to Ukraine ahead of the full-scale invasion last year, which Berlin delayed, of course, to the cost of Ukrainians. Does it take self-awareness to make a region as well? And is there potential for a regionality to actually emerge? Or is this just a way of understanding that there are particular stories you can tell that have more generalizable relevance from looking around this place? How should we consider the Baltic?
I think the latter. I don't think that you need a grassroots sense of regional Baltic identity in order for it to be a meaningful entity. I think it just functions as one from an economic perspective, from a political perspective, from a military perspective. And I am choosing to make it one from an ideas perspective too. People are absolutely at liberty to disagree with that. But I really think that there is something to do with this kind of centrifuge of different national languages and extremely different cultures, kind of different language families, different in completely different sort of migratory histories, very different perspectives, all kind of being smashed together by geographical necessity since as far back as the Bronze Age, that has made it an absolutely fascinating region, even if people aren't necessarily inclined to think of themselves as being part of something greater.
Right, so from the Bronze Age to Bronze Knight and beyond, we can consider the politics of the Baltic. And we might actually, I think one of the points that really struck me when reading what you'd written was that this is a successful region, that this is a success story that is not, that is undertold. And we need success stories at the moment in order to understand how we can continue to work to take that danger out of difference, be that linguistic difference, ethnic difference, historical difference, and to create a more positive future from it.
But are we necessarily even learning from those success stories, even where they exist? There's a few examples that I'll bring up here. I mean, you know, you were mentioning, you even have a few chapters in this upcoming book that focus on energy and energy security. And of course, I think that you, Ben, you and I, from recording our energy episode recently, could probably say that even if there's certain successful, stable sources of energy, particularly in Central and Eastern Europe, Poland, the Baltics, even in France, that even where successful case studies exist, that there are going to be people in Germany who aren't necessarily going to want to go for those things. We've seen, for example, how successful, at least so far, Finland has been integrated into NATO. I mean, so we have two potential success stories here, one on energy and one on even on NATO integration, that it would seem as if German politicians at the very highest levels don't seem to want to even learn from. I mean, where can we even go?
Yeah, I mean, since you mentioned nuclear energy.
Is that what you were talking about, Aaron?
It might have been, even if I didn't mention it by name, but we all know what I'm saying, right?
Well, the Baltic is the cradle of the nuclear renaissance in Europe that we're seeing now. Not only Sweden and Finland investing very heavily in expanding their nuclear fleets, Poland building its first nuclear reactor, right. Estonia, just today, as we're finishing recording this podcast, receiving the results of an International Atomic Energy Agency report into its potential to start generating nuclear power. Finland has just got the first European pressurized reactor, which is, I think, the most powerful nuclear reactor in the West, up and running at Olkiluoto 3. And, like, most interestingly of all, they've also built the world's first deep geological storage facility for nuclear waste, thereby solving one of the single hardest engineering problems in energy, where Germany and Britain and the US have failed for decades.
As a former science journalist, you're well placed to explain to us how that actually works.
You dig a really, really deep tunnel under the sea, under some really impermeable rock, and you make little kind of royal burial chambers. And in each one of those, you drill a hole and you put a very, very thickly swaddled copper canister of nuclear waste in it and just wait for about 100,000 years or something for it to lose its radioactivity.
Now, even in a country such as Germany, which prizes slowness as a virtue, I can't imagine that convincing some of the German Greens that that's actually a solution. It is still very much burying it, isn't it?
It is burying it. Yeah. But, you know, such is the geology of Onkalo that there seems to be a very reasonable likelihood that it would take an absolutely apocalyptic earthquake to cause any kind of contamination.
Your book stands to do a wonderful service, is highlighting these success stories, whatever they may be, from, as you say, nuclear storage to the successful reintegration of countries across what was formerly the Cold War divide, to looking at how you actually make the best of economic ties that have been longstanding but let go, and how you revivify those in a serious way. Does Germany actually have Baltic eyes? Can it actually see these success stories? And what should it really be looking at?
No, it doesn't. I mean, I barely see them present in German public discourse or in the German press. And I'm not aware that German politicians are turning up to the events that the Baltic countries are organizing, or events about the Baltic in Berlin that I go to. And in terms of the success stories it should be looking at, I think this idea that we have seen above all in Finland and in Estonia, that broad spectrum grand strategy is absolutely essential for safeguarding the future of a country and its prosperity, and that has to be a coordinated process that goes across your education system, across your digitization process, across your energy supply, across your corporate regulation, across your industrial strategy and your corporatism, and all of those concepts fitting together into a coherent whole. That is something that I think in this particular moment, when so many things in Germany seem to be tilting or wobbling or falling over, would be the way to try and think about it.
Right. And I mean, that comes back to understanding who you are, what you want, where you want to go, and how you're going to get there, which are all the challenges that we talk about a lot on Berlin Side Out. So it's interesting to see there are examples to draw on in very close proximity, should Germans choose to look for them.
And what about the other example or a success story that we were looking at? And that is, Finnish NATO membership so far. We've seen them single-handedly get rid of the security doctrine, or at least the name of it, Finlandization. I mean, we can't use this term anymore, even though certainly political elites in Germany liked to use it for years and years and years, especially even to suggest before the war started that this was a solution for Ukraine. That it should be, kept out of NATO as some sort of buffer state. And we've seen this kind of dashed. But yet we don't see the chancellery sitting there being like, oh, look at Finland and let's apply that lesson to Ukraine. So we've been discussing NATO quite a bit in this podcast, and how the Baltic Sea started from being an EU lake and is now becoming Lake NATO as well. What are some of the key challenges, Ollie, in your view, from writing this book that are kind of coming up, and even in terms of securing this entire region with Finland and Swedish NATO accession? Let's start maybe with some of the naval ones, because that's also been a focus, also with Polish rearmament is also having a strong navy to police this region. But then let's go to some of the other larger security challenges more broadly as well.
Well, from a naval perspective, there's just been almost boundless good news over the past 18 months for NATO in the Baltic, in that once Sweden is a NATO member, NATO will then be able to control the two principal choke points at either end of the Baltic Sea, namely the Öresund between Sweden and Denmark, and the Gulf of Finland between Finland and Estonia. And also, very, very critically, the Swedish island of Gotland, which is pretty much about as central as it is possible to be, it's sometimes described as a natural aircraft carrier, will be on NATO terrain. We'll be able to put A2AD capabilities on there that'll allow us to protect these naval reinforcement lines towards the Baltic states if we ever need to use them.
So unser Gotland, if not quite mein Gotland.
Well, crucially, Gott mit uns Land now. And we also get the Swedish and Finnish navies, by the way, which are not huge, but are very, very well designed for the process of coastal defence that they've been set up to do.
So from good news on the naval front, however, one of the chapters of your book, wonderfully entitled Peace Through Superior Firepower, and a tip of the hat to our friends at NAFO and elsewhere, talks about how an exercise, Titan Shield, a large-scale war game held in Latvia, where a British Army detachment, red teaming, playing the enemy, simulated an invasion and was able to actually wreak a considerable amount of havoc across a multinational force until the Polish armor showed up, as you put it. Tell us more about that.
This was such a fascinating exercise to follow for two reasons. First, that in order to get there from their base in northeastern Poland, this detachment, largely made up of Royal Lancers, had to drive through the Suwalki Gap. And it turns out that in order to get across the Suwalki Gap, you require a separate series of detailed paperwork for every single territory that you cross. By the way, also, you need different sets of paperwork for every Bundesland in Germany.
As we heard from Ben Hodges on episode 3.
Right. Indeed.
And this was the first time that the British military had made that journey with armoured vehicles in preparation for a NATO exercise. So it's ironing out the logistics. And I know this is something that your team at the DGRP is also working on. How do we get sufficient quantities of armor into the Baltic states if we need to at rapid pace? But the second really fascinating dimension of this exercise is, on the one side, you have about 90 British Army troops, very mobile, used to operating in small units or about six under cover of night, very, very flexible and tactically innovative. On the other side, you have this gigantic Canadian-led multinational battle group with, I think, 11 different member states underneath them, with American Patriots looking after their air defense, with Spanish and Italian Eurofighter air support. And the Brits are able to exploit the interoperability issues, you know, the language barriers, the disparate training regimes, to cause absolute havoc. And this exercise was going pretty dicily, I think, from the defenders' perspective, despite their overwhelming numerical superiority, until the Polish tanks showed up, and then it was curtains.
Which again points to the significance of Poland's military resurgence and the need for it, the need for that large, capable ground force at the heart of NATO in one of its frontline states, which of course Germany provided during the Cold War. So this is something Germany should be able to relate to. And of course, Defense Minister Boris Pistorius frequently refers to his experience growing up in that frontline Cold War environment. So this is a particular area where it shouldn't be beyond the capability of the current German government, let alone future ones, to actually see how this situation is developing, learn from it, and understand how to support it. Oliver, you've travelled a lot around the Baltic in the course of researching this book, but also in the course of your work for The Times. Perhaps you could give our listeners a sense of some of the magic of some of the places you've been to in the region, some places you might recommend to visit, and what you learned there in particular, just a couple of stories that might highlight that. For example, good trips to Vilnius, or we could ignore our rooftop bar experience there. But good trips to Vilnius or Riga or other places that you found particularly inspiring.
Absolutely. Well, if you haven't been to Riga, I would say it is an absolutely magnificent city that acquired most of its most distinctive Jugendstil Art Deco architecture at the dawn of the 20th century under a British mayor called George Armitage. George's Armitages, I think, under the Latvian spelling convention. And it's just a city with an absolutely wonderful history as one of the kind of dominant commercial ice-free ports of the Baltic Sea, a great big cosmopolitan melting pot, one of my favourite places. But my absolute favourite place in the Baltic is where I went to after the NATO summit in Vilnius, which is Neringa, the Curonian Spit. So if you go up to the Lithuanian port of Klaipeda, which, by the way, is also home to the Baltic state's first LNG terminal, huge source of energy security, you can get a boat across to this 50-kilometre spit of sand separating a lagoon from the Baltic Sea. And this sort of wonderful undulating dune landscape going in and out of forest. And then you come up to the end and there's a weird little hut thing. And then there is a sign in Russian and you realize, shit, this is Kaliningrad.
or Kralovets, as it's properly known. And that was something missing from your book, was the Czech connection to the Baltic.
Well, actually, the I believe it's now going to be known as Königsberg by the Estonians.
Oh, the German connection.
In a show of Estonian soft power towards Germany there.
I think a show of magnanimity.
There we go, a show of magnanimity. So, I mean, certainly Aaron and I have both travelled in the Baltic states themselves a lot. And I love both Vilnius and Tallinn. Aaron, I know you're a fan of Riga too.
I'm a huge fan of Riga. And I would second Ollie there. Great Christmas markets, even for those who are used to German ones, which are pretty fabulous. You can eat yourself stupid. And also, we've talked a lot on Berlin Side Out about the Baltic experience of occupation and how it differs from German memory culture, which we, of course, criticize as being selective. And the Museum of the Occupation in Riga is just a one-stop must-visit place where you can really, really, really understand that sort of Baltic nightmare of that comes from that memory culture. Thanks very much to our friend Oliver Moody for joining us this week.
Yeah, it's been brilliant to have you on the show and to give us a sneak preview of what is going to be a fascinating book that I would highly recommend everyone to read when it comes out next year with...
It'll be published by John Murray and out at the start of 2025.
Out at the start of 2025, available in paperback, hardback and Kindle,
yes.
Presumably.
Mark your calendars, everyone. I think Ben and I will be taking friendship privilege by getting to read it early. We're looking forward to it. You can also find some of Oliver's other reading, or writing, I should say, in our show notes. Thank you too to our team at Degapay this week. That's all for this episode of Berlin Side Out. Join us over the next few weeks as we get into the discussions we've started now on the exciting Baltic region, as well as Germany's relationships with its partners around Europe, including in the Baltic, across the Atlantic, and the challenges and opportunities coming up in the next few years around those in geopolitical flux. Until until then, auf Wiedersehen and tschüss.
Do Virginia.